everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Haunted History Chronicles. Joining me today is Aoife Sutton, who is a doctoral student in archaeological and forensic science. We're going to be talking about a range of topics, something that I think you're going to find really fascinating. So stay tuned and let me introduce you to Aoife.
Hi Aoife, it's so great to have you joining us today. Now, I know you are fascinated by the paranormal and the macabre and death omens and so on. Where did that kind of start for you? How did you kind of get on that journey, on that path of exploring some of those topics?
So I come from quite a historical area back in Ireland. I grew up on an area called the Hook Peninsula, which is in Featherdon Sea. And we have a really long history there, particularly around Norman invasion. And as a teenager, I worked at the oldest operational lighthouse in the world as a tour guide. So it was a summer job and I got a lot of experience working in heritage, and I went on to study archaeology. And I just always had an interest in archaeology, history, death and dying, and all those kind of linked subjects. So going on to study archaeology in the past and kind of the macabre aspects of the past was just something that felt really natural to me. But I'd taken a little bit of a morbid turn, I guess. I was about a year into my archaeology degree and my dad died suddenly when I was around 19. So it was an unexpected death. And that really changed my perspective on things and kind of my research interests, as my mom got quite ill after he died. And she actually passed away from illness in 2019. And they both died quite young and I was quite young. So I had a lot of experience with death and dying at a young age. And my parents weren't old when they died. They were only 48 and 50. And they both died in very different circumstances. And in Ireland in particular, we're very involved when a loved one dies. So for instance, we often wake our loved ones at home. And, you know, embalming is quite a big practice in Ireland. I first seen my dead loved one when I was 8 and it was my grandfather. So I always felt that death was something I could handle. Not that it didn't affect me or anything. And funerals are quite a big thing back in Ireland. We sit with the dead body. People listen to death announcements on the radio. I read a book recently by the state pathologist who was in Ireland for a long time. And I believe she's originally from Scotland. And she really summed it up when she said the Irish are a little bit obsessed with death. You know, and it's so true because it just seemed to be everywhere growing up. And yeah, it's one of those things that when I experienced it so personally and when I was growing up with it in a rural community, I guess those experiences really drove me into that aspect of research, because obviously archaeology isn't kind of my main focus, but I do death-based stuff and that's where it came from. I was already studying archaeology, but because of personal circumstances and interest itself, that's the direction I went in. And I think archaeology and death are pretty intertwined. You know, and I always think it's really interesting because there's some elements of death that we may think of as strange, but it's normal for someone else. Like, for instance, when I came to the UK at first, I always thought it was really strange that the loved one doesn't always go home to the house sometimes. Yeah. Whereas in Ireland, that's something that we do, especially in rural Ireland. And yeah, that's how I got into death studies and how I got into archaeology in particular.
And from there, you've been creating this project, haven't you? And hence pathological bodies on Instagram and so on, where you're really kind of sharing some of that research and discussion and interest to open up the wider topic of death and things surrounding death to other people, which is brilliant. Do you want to just explain a little bit more about your blog and your PhD project?
Yeah, so my PhD research is looking at the use and obtainment of anatomical fluid preserved remains from the 18th and 19th centuries. I'm really, really interested in how people view historical soft tissue on display in museums in comparison to other historical remains, such as skeletal remains or mummies, because they're obviously quite different in appearance. when you get down to it. Like when you see, when you see soft tissue on display, even if it is historical, it can still affect people a lot more, I think. And even though, like they're 18th and 19th centuries, but they're not modern donors that you'd see in the likes of Body World's exhibit. And you see identifiable features such as hair and birthmarks that you wouldn't see on skeletal remains. So they are quite identifiable. And I think we see ourselves in them quite easily when we look at them. And I think they can tell us a lot about post-mortem bodily integrity and consent.
Mm-hmm.
So many of these remains in particular may have been taken without consent. And it may actually have gone against their religious beliefs to have been dissected, particularly 200 years ago or more. You know, you're talking about a time when people wanted the body to be whole for resurrection.
Yeah.
And, you know, that they didn't want this. And a lot of them were from very poor communities that were being obtained. And I think these collections are such a fantastic historical resource that really help aid conversation surrounding themes such as death and dying and bereavement and display of their preserved body. And they just really link into archaeology in particular. And I've done some training with a local embalmer and in the local mortuary, which obviously doesn't fall within the realm of archaeology all the time, but it was really good in helping me understand as an archaeologist the complexity of the dead body and the modern dead body and kind of being faced with death head on. Mm. And it really helped in death research itself. So at the minute with the PhD project, I'm trying to survey as many institutes as I possibly can and see if they have these fluid preserved remains in their collections. And then I'm hoping to do some interviews with professionals and see what their attitudes are towards them and see how they're cared for and see how they're used, if they're used in teaching or if how much of their collections are really on display and how they can be used to really bring up some really important topics that people find really difficult to talk about. And I think when you use a historical collection, it might be make it a little bit easier in some aspects. And I started the blog back in 2019, which is Pathological Bodies Project, as you said. And it really was an outlet for me because my mother was in the last few months of her life and I was working in retail at the time. And I really, because I needed to be flexible and I needed to go back and to Ireland. And I knew I wanted to pursue a PhD in archaeology and death related topic, but it wasn't the right time.
Mm.
Because it was a bit of a juggle with everything. And this was a bit of an outlet where I could research topics at my own pace, try and get my name out there, try and have somewhere to kind of do the research that I was really interested in. And the topics themselves range quite a bit. So they range from, say, the postmortem integrity of Marilyn Monroe, which is probably one of my most read blog posts, to the archaeology of epidemics or embalming. And I set up the Instagram a bit later on where I try to post a bit more regularly because it's quite hard to blog when you're trying to juggle a PhD and other jobs. Yeah.
Too many plates.
Too many plates. I work on another project called Dying to Talk, which is trying to open up conversations about death and dying amongst young people in a non-morbid way, so to say. We use archaeology quite a bit to do that. And between that and, you know, doing PhD, the time does get away from you, even though they're all related and they're all on topic. And, you know, death is kind of my life in a way. But yeah, so that's what my research is looking at and sort of how I kind of got into the blogging itself.
I mean, it fascinates me. And, you know, some of the things that you've touched on there, I just think really resonate because it's a question to ask, isn't it? Why is it that we are more comfortable seeing something on display in a museum, you know, such as if you travel to Pompeii, where you can see the casts of those that passed away at Pompeii? Why is that more acceptable to go and view and to learn about and to study and to, you know, take away information about, as opposed to seeing something that, like you mentioned, that we can see ourselves in simply because there's those, you know, that remains there that make it feel much more human, much more real, much more human-like? Why is one more acceptable than the other? Is it, you know, there's a whole host of kind of things that crop up from that. Is it to do with time? Is it just to do with how they appear and how they look that makes one thing more or less acceptable than the other? It's intriguing, and it's certainly kind of opens up a whole kind of debate in itself, doesn't it, in terms of where you kind of sit on that scale. And I don't think there's necessarily a right or a wrong answer. Sometimes it's very personal, and sometimes it can be very much down to the individual thing that you're looking at and why you think that might be important, and why something else may be a little bit more kind of questionable in terms of should this be something that we study and take things from.
Yeah, and I think, like you said, it's a very personal choice in how, you know, I wouldn't even say choice. It's a very personal reaction sometimes to people. I mean, I've visited medical museums with friends in the past, and I've had some that just couldn't bear to be there. And then there's people like me who, you know, I'm extremely intrigued by them. And like you say as well, you have people on display in museums and in collections, and people would feel more comfortable viewing them than they would going to see a loved one as well. And that's another thing in itself. And obviously the personal element there can be really a difficult struggle for people, but it is definitely interesting, and there's no right or wrong answer. And it's funny because you have all these remains that could be the same age, but because of their different levels of preservation, one is like more acceptable than the other, or because one part is being preserved and another part isn't. Then say if you saw an organ, for example, by itself, is that more acceptable than seeing a face or hands? Because that's a lot more humanizing than, you know, just seeing a heart or a kidney, because you don't see them every day, do you? You don't see them when you look in the mirror.
No, you're right.
But you would see, you know, hands, and you see a face. And it's the same with skeletal remains as well, I guess. Obviously, coming from an archaeological background, I was very well acquainted with skeletal remains before I started to do some embalming training. And I think, yes, it did prepare me a little bit, but it's not the same. And you don't see your skeleton every day. You know, you don't look in the mirror and see it. You know, it's like another thing that's once removed. And it doesn't have that identifiable feature to it. And I think it makes it a little bit less scary and a little bit less impactful for people. Not that, you know, these are not humans and these are not human remains, but I think people don't feel as I suppose struck by them sometimes.
And like I said, I don't think there's any right or wrong. It's to do with where you fall in that. It's remembering that if these are used, there's so much, like you mentioned, that you can take from it, that you can learn about that person's life, that you can learn about the history of that time in terms of how, you know, people were treated in death, certain parts of society and how they were treated in death. You know, there's so much that it can reveal that sheds a light on part of our history and what's happened before that we can really explore and learn from. And, you know, I think those are important things to not lose sight of and to know about. So I think it's brilliant that you're kind of putting a spotlight on some of those things and allowing people to engage in those conversations and discussions and topics on a scale where they're comfortable. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think what's kind of interesting about it as well is that you find that if you say to somebody, oh, these remains are on display and they've been used in this manner, but they probably didn't have consent. How do you feel about that? And people are often very kind of a little bit outraged, I guess, sometimes, depending on who you talk to. And then in the same breath as well, you would ask them, well, what do you want to happen to your body after you die? And what does your loved one want after they die? And it's people just don't want to talk about that.
No.
And it's like saying, you know, you have all these archaeological remains that I come across in museums that, you know, it's very questionable with sometimes where they've come from. And people are more concerned about that than they're concerned about their own loved ones sometimes. And it's a very strange kind of way of thinking, but I think when it's personal, people do find it a lot harder to talk about. But I think trying to bring up these conversations in the blogging and, you know, in looking at historical remains can make it a little bit easier, I guess, and a little bit more accessible.
And again, I think that's the, you know, the beautiful part of what you're doing, because it is a huge over kind of arching umbrella, and you're allowing people to explore the many different topics and areas and themes and questions, superstitions, whatever it is, in the areas that they want to, on a level that they want to. And just, it's a starting point, isn't it? And I think that's the main thing, that, you know, this is something that impacts on us all, and to be able to talk about it is important, you know, to have this understanding, to not shy away from it. It shouldn't be something that's taboo, I don't think.
No, and I think it's funny, because I often have to check myself sometimes, because I wouldn't say desensitized, but I'm very comfortable in talking about death, and I'm very comfortable in talking about, you know, the death of my parents, and, you know, just death in general. And I think some people find it very uncomfortable. Mm. You know, and I think people find it a little bit disarming sometimes, and they don't really know what to make of it, or why would you possibly be interested in something like that? And I just can't help but think, you know, it happens to everybody. There's no avoiding it. It's something we all have to talk about. And it's really interesting to see what's considered normal now when you're thinking about the dead body, and what was considered normal in the past, and, you know, what people considered easier to talk about than other topics.
I agree. And I think if you look at kind of the trajectory of how things have changed and evolved, we seem to have become more sensitive to the topic. You know, when death was more present in people's lives, it kind of meant that death was ever present. And so it was part of your home. It was part of your family's, you know, it was something that you're experiencing in a much more visceral sense, I think. And so therefore it wasn't something that people shied away from and weren't quite so kind of closed-minded in terms of talking about it. Yeah, and you can see that in terms of the superstitions, you know, funeral practices, mourning practices, what they would wear, so many different things, that it just kind of embodied, you know, quite large parts of their life. And I think over time what we've seen is it become more and more taboo, something that is just something you don't want to talk about. It kind of highlights our own mortality, whereas I think 100 years ago, 200 years ago, that wasn't something you could necessarily shy away from. It was there.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not to say as well that people in the past, you know, in the last couple of hundred years didn't feel that bereavement.
No.
And weren't grieving, because they were, you know, they were really struggling, and they were impacted by these deaths, but they just seem to be a little bit more, you know, open to talking about it. And I think by talking about things in the past and how we've gotten to our death culture today, like how has that developed through time, and why do we do the things we do today, is really useful in opening up these conversations. I in the department I work in, I work with an archaeologist, and she ran a project called Continuum Bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a project which used archaeology to open up conversations about death and dying.
Yeah.
And they found that, you know, people were much more able to talk about their own death once they were looking at death in the past and death in a historical context, because it was a gateway into these conversations.
Mm-hmm.
And it made it a lot easier to kind of take on such a challenging topic, because it wasn't immediately about them straight away, you know, and the conversation just naturally came to death today and how we look after the dead bodies today. And, you know, and it was just a natural progression. Mm-hmm. And I think it really stands to tell you that, you know, looking at things in the past really do help with conversations today.
I can say from my own experience being a teacher, you know, I've taught children who sadly lost close loved ones, be it, you know, a grandparent. In some cases, they've lost a parent. And, you know, I know the importance of being able to have the language to talk about death and the feelings that's associated with, because when they don't have that, that's when they struggle. And empowering those children, giving them those tools and a safe space where they can talk about death, be it in a very removed context or a very personal context, is something that has helped them as part of that grieving process. And so, you know, like we've been saying, sometimes not having that openness in the way that maybe mm-hmm. was there in the past is something that, you know, just in itself is something to kind of think about and consider in terms of how we go about our everyday lives. You know, is this something that we just keep hush hush, or, you know, do we have those kinds of conversations with our own loved ones? Are we able to talk about it ourselves?
Yeah, and what we have found with the Dying to Talk project, which is aimed at young people, is that when we are, you know, approaching schools to try and talk to young people about this stuff, and we find that it's the adults who have the most issue
with
talking about it completely. Like, they just don't want to.
How to raise something without them getting very upset.
Yeah, and I mean, children and young people are resilient, you know, when it comes to death in particular. That has been my experience. It obviously is very unsettling for some, but in my experience, I always found that they were more resilient and more willing to talk about it than adults themselves. And something that really kind of struck me as well when I was talking to young people is that they didn't like the whole, you know, talking in code and euphemisms.
No, they don't.
Surrounding death. No.
They just like to have the plain kind of facts.
Yep.
Not something sugar-coated.
Yeah,
have an honest
exactly.
conversation, to be honest.
Yeah, and like, you know, she's gone on, or she's passed away, or they've gone to a better place, you know. And although these kind of phrases are really, they're coming from a good place, they're very confusing.
They are.
For young people and for children. A lot of them don't particularly understand it. And I think you have to try and find that good balance where you're telling them that somebody has died, but by, you know, not being too assertive or aggressive in your approach, but by also making sure you get to what you want to say and so that they understand.
I completely agree. So, yeah, I'm fully on board with that, because I've seen that firsthand where children have been just very confused because they're getting something kind of fed to them and shared with them that does come from a place of just really caring and trying to make this moment bearable. But by watering it down, it's just left them very confused as to what is happening and what's happened to their loved one and what that means to them. So it doesn't allow them that space to then grieve, because what it's filled with instead is confusion. And when there's confusion, you don't necessarily know how to kind of ask those questions to find out what's happened, because it's then very difficult for that person to unpick. And so, yeah, I think having that ability to talk about this amongst our loved ones, our friends, you know, our families, is something that, like I said, is just something that we should be able to do on a level to start with, whatever is comfortable, and just, you know, see where it goes, really, when it's necessary.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, it's, I mean, not everybody is going to be comfortable with it, and you don't have to be straight away, and you don't have to feel 100% comfortable with it. But I think as a society, I guess it's trying to approach the subject in a non-morbid manner, but also one that's true to form as well, I guess. Like, you're saying the facts and you're talking about death openly, but you're doing it in a way that, you know, people are comfortable with.
And it's healthy. Yes. I think that's the main thing. It's a healthy discussion, as opposed to something that is morbid, but it is a, do you want to talk about this? And just being honest.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, talking about death doesn't mean you're going to die.
No.
You know, like, straight away, you know, like, it's, you know, it's one of those things where you're not, just by talking about it doesn't mean you're going to make it happen in the next day or two or anything, you know. And I think that's what people are afraid of.
Yeah.
It's like, if I talk about it, it makes it real, you know. So, yeah, I just hope that people, you know, going forward and as we progress as a society as well, that we are more open about it. And I don't know if it's the Irishness in me, but I tend to be very open about it and very open about death and the dead body. But yeah, and yeah, as a culture, it's just, we just had it quite a lot growing up. You know, we had the whole, you know, like I said, the body at home. And it's just really interesting coming to a different country and where that wasn't the case. It was just really interesting to me.
And it fascinates me how death, and again, that wide umbrella when you look at death in terms of how a body is treated, death superstitions, death folklore, all of those different aspects, when you look at different cultures around the world, you know, ancient civilizations, you know, going forward into more modern times, how they are just all very different. And yet at the core of so many of them is something that is very similar in terms of respect for their loved one and doing the right thing for their loved one in helping them on to the next place, whatever that belief system is. And so, yeah, it's fascinating. And that's where, again, I think your blog gives people kind of a window into some of those areas to go and look at. And certainly for me, I, you know, it's fascinating. It's like a little treasure trove that you can dip into.
Thank you.
There's a couple on there that, you know, were just really fascinating. And I think they resonated because they're things that I've looked at for, you know, previous podcasts or upcoming podcasts. And again, just, you come away learning something new, something that you haven't come across. And it's so thorough and so well researched that it's just, they make for brilliant reads. They really do. And one of them was, you know, your discussion and your topic about Victorians as these dark tourists, which I think is a wonderful phrase in itself. Do you want to explain what you meant by kind of dark tourism?
Yeah. So, I mean, dark tourism is, it's an umbrella term, and it refers to, you know, archaeology and museums and other heritage aspects that are linked to themes such as death and tragedy and destruction. It's kind of difficult to really define, but when you think of it today, I suppose you think of, you know, graveyards, disaster sites, murder trails, and that sort of thing. And I guess when you think of those kind of topics, death and the macabre, people do often think of the Victorians and their so-called morbid fascination with death. And I mean, they did do death
very well.
Yes, they did. And, you know, when you think of mourning and when you think of death, you do think of Victorians straight away. And it was during this time that we did get the rise of the medical museum, you know, and we have the famous Paris morgue, and you have mummy unwrappings. So you have different aspects that are, I suppose you can see the links today. You can see, you know, the medical museums of today, or people not unwrapping a mummy, but going to see them in museums. You know, like, these are all considered modern dark tourism. And when you couple these type of, you know, tourist spots with a society that was so well acquainted with death and was just constantly dressed in black from one morning to the next, I think you really do have the ultimate dark tourist. And that's really what I was talking about on the blog. And I was talking about those three examples in particular.
Yeah, the Medical Museum in Oxford Street, it's not one that I'd heard of. So it's fascinating kind of exploring the kinds of things that were on display, what happened to the museum itself. It's just really intriguing because, like I said, that wasn't one that I'd ever come across or heard about. So,
yeah, it's really interesting. And what I really liked, it was Dr. Joseph Kahn's museum. And it was controversial at the time, but also popular. Mm. And what I quite liked about it is that they had ladies' times and slots. So ladies could only go in separately and view certain specimens because the other ones are a little bit too offensive for them to view. Only medical men could view these certain specimens, you know. And it's just so funny to think, like, because today when you think of, you know, the people who I come across in death studies and in medical museums are overwhelmingly women. So it's funny that when you're reading back and thinking about it, it's like, oh no, they couldn't possibly see that, you know. It's funny because it's just such a contrast to today, really.
Yeah, and again, just putting that spotlight, isn't it, in terms of, you can see a journey as to how it's evolved into certain things today, like you were mentioning, when you go to a museum and you see mummies, you can see modern day equivalents. And so it's fascinating being able to put those two things side by side to compare, because we look at one and we think, oh, that's horrifying, that's shocking. But actually,
yeah, we do something kind of similar in a way.
Somehow that's okay. That gets the stamp of approval. It's really interesting. And likewise, when you know, you explore what the Victorians did around mourning and their superstitions around mourning, well, compare those with modern day funerals, mm-hmm. and you can see huge similarities. You can see kind of the birth of what we do today, if you like, around funerals. So many of those things that they were doing in the Victorian times are things that have kind of come down that we still use today. And so we think of the Victorians as, like you said, the experts in death. And yes, they were. they really did take it very seriously. But they're all things that still resonate today in modern society. And I think that's what's really interesting about being able to explore where those things might have started from, really.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, you think of like wearing black, you know, obviously that was extremely Victorian, mm-hmm. with Queen Victoria being in mourning, and she really shaped that way of thinking. And, you know, that was the appropriate thing to do, but we still wear black today. And I mean, yes, it can be a request that some people have, that, you know, they don't want people to wear black at their funerals. And it's not as strict, obviously, but that's, you know, that's where it came from. And I think it's just so interesting how we kind of see they're kind of this conundrum, the Victorians, with, were they fascinated with death, or did they just have a really healthy approach, or did it, you know, was it, which was which, you know, like how can we define what was normal and what is normal by today's standards? And I mean, like, open coffins were common back then. Open coffins are still common now. And mourning jewelry. I personally wear a locket around my neck with some of my mother's hair. And that was an extremely popular thing to do during the Victorian period, with, you know, mourning jewelry and the hair lockets and the hair bracelets and everything, you know. So it's just interesting looking at the past to see how it's shaped us today as a mourning, you know, as a society in mourning.
Oh, I completely agree. And the more you kind of go into it, it's like a little rabbit warren, the more you kind of uncover and unearth. And it's just really intriguing, like I said, to kind of see that journey, to see how it has evolved into what we do today. It's brilliant kind of have a look at. So if anybody hasn't, that's certainly one that I would suggest going and having a look at on your blog, because it's really interesting. The other one that I found fascinating was this kind of discussion about death folklore, in particular folklore from Ireland. And you wrote about Bridget Cleary, which resonated a lot for me, because obviously I've done podcasts on the part in the past about witchcraft and how people could be persecuted as witches, and the reasons for that, the rise of witchcraft. And I've looked at, you know, places like Pendle in Salem, but the wider issue. And it's a really fascinating story. It's a macabre story, but it's one that really does kind of resonate for so many different reasons, because if you look at the persecution of people as witches and the story of Bridget Cleary, you know, we're talking about 200 years difference. And yet this was a woman in 1895 who was being persecuted because of superstitions.
Yeah.
It was a fascinating read. Do you want to kind of explain a little bit about Bridget Cleary for anybody that doesn't know anything about her?
Yeah. So Bridget Cleary is considered the last witch killing in Ireland, as you said, in 1895. And you do think of the Salem witch trials and, you know, Matthew Hopkins, you know, and that sort of thing. You know, you don't tend to think of it as just over 100 years ago.
No.
But this happened in quite a rural community in Ireland. And there's a lot of themes linked to her death. Religion, superstition, oppression, and patriarchy are quite a lot of themes that come up when people tend to discuss her her killing, I guess. And she was from a very rural village, and she was a dressmaker. And she was a little bit different. She would wear attire that would have been commented on. You know, she would have worn, oh, God forbid, you know, she wore a black hat with feathers in, you know, or ribbon, you know. And it was something that people just were a little bit suspicious of her, I guess. And she just was a little bit different, a little bit independent. She had her, when she was dressmaking, she had her own company doing it. And she got ill one day, and for some reason her husband and some local believers just thought she had been either bewitched or that a changeling had taken her place. And she was murdered by them because of this. And she was murdered because, you know, they were really suspicious of her. And they assaulted her. They tried to force feed her. You know, she was aggressively shook. She was sick, very sick, with either bronchitis or pneumonia. And that just wasn't, you know, being looked at as a reason why she was ill. It was, you know, she had to have been, you know, by a changeling or by a witch. You know, that had to be the reason. And she was killed, and her body was buried in a shallow grave near her house. And eventually it did all come out that this had occurred. But, you know, she was kind of buried then unceremoniously in a grave in the local graveyard. And I felt when I was researching her that it brought out so many elements surrounding death, and it brought out so many elements surrounding oppression and what happens to the body after death.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about a very Catholic society, you know, so it was for her to be buried unceremoniously at the time.
Thing.
Yeah, it was a very big thing. And she was really just killed because she, you know, was different. And, you know, she was a different woman in a society when, you know, women were meant to be a certain way. And although you'd probably consider her an isolated incident, I guess, in the sense that it was pretty recent, it had happened quite a lot in the past. And to look at very interesting subjects. And I do recommend having a look at the blog if you want to have a look at her in more detail.
It's incredibly in-depth. I mean, I've read her story, you know, in other places, but I have to say I've not read anything as well documented in terms of the detail from the very beginning all the way through to post, sadly, what happened to her, you know, after death, in terms of how she was treated. It was just incredibly thorough. And it meant that you really were able to see the story of her life and her death from so many different sides. So it's definitely one I would suggest you go and have a look at, because it was intriguing and sad. But
yeah, sad, I think. And I think it's one of those things where you actually don't, like, she's not a very well-known case.
No.
And she should be.
Yeah, she should.
You know, she should be, but she's not very well known. I think it's because it wasn't done in the traditional witch type of hunting way, if you get what I mean. As in, like, it was her family who had done it. It wasn't authorities who had, you know, gone and sought her out. And it's just a very, very sad case. Brings up a lot of themes.
Mm-hmm.
And I read a book by Angela Burke called The Burning of Bridget Cleary, A True Story. So if anybody's interested in learning a lot more about her, I definitely would give that a read for sure.
Yeah, and you will come away from it with so many thoughts about, like you said, it touches on so many things that, you know, just are so worth thinking about and just not dismissing, to really understand the complexities of what happened and to really understand it, because she deserves that, because it was a brutal, brutal death. And what happened to her in death was just as brutal in a different way, because it was almost like punishing her in death. And so to understand what happened to her in those moments of her death and afterwards is necessary, so that her voice, you know, what happened, doesn't get lost. And to understand, like I said, the complexities around that is so vital to understand our histories, our, you know, histories of our different cultures and the kinds of things that happened all around the world to individuals, to groups, is just really important, I think. But yeah, it's definitely one that I think people should go and have a look at. And like I said, it really resonated for me simply because it's something that I've explored myself when it comes to witch trials. And it's just that element, isn't it, of someone being different, being superstitious of someone for the most minor little things sometimes, trying to find an excuse, a reason for why something that people were feared of is happening. Who can that be likened to? What can it be likened to? You know, just trying to make sense of things that people were scared of or unsure of. And unfortunately, sometimes people innocently being caught up in that along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Yeah, definitely, definitely. And yeah, as you say, it does bring up a lot of themes and a lot of important discussions about the body after death and, you know, death in society.
Yeah. And again, that resonates, you know, if you look at what happened in England around burials and who were denied burials in England for various different reasons, you know, you can see the same thing resonating in other countries and other cultures. And you know, again, those are all things to kind of not shy away from, but to understand.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. And I think with difficult cases like that as well, people don't really tend to want to talk about it either, which, you know, I can see why people might not want to talk about it. They might think, you know, the past is in the past, but I mean, we have to learn from it.
Absolutely.
You know, we have to learn from the past and we have to, you know, use it for a good thing, I guess.
No, I agree. And I think that's the perfect way to think about it, to take from it what we need to take from it, to learn from it and to go forward.
Yeah.
So did you have a particular blog on there that you really loved researching and writing about that was a favourite or something that just stood out for you?
There was a few. I quite enjoyed, and it's not my realm usually, but I did do a blog post on post-mortem integrity of Marilyn Monroe. And that was quite a popular blog post, to say the least. It probably gets the most views than a lot of the other ones. And I think it's because when you think of her, you think of, you know, this big star and this vivacious blonde bombshell on our movie screens. And there was so much controversy surrounding her death that I think people really forgot, you know, how she was treated when she died. You know, her body was, you know, pictures were being taken of her body by the paparazzi. There has been rumors that people were bribing morgue assistants to get in to take pictures of her in the morgue and to take pictures of, you know, the room itself where she died. And it's just really sad to think about it. You know, she was constantly in front of the camera in life, and then in death the same thing was happening. And she was talked about kind of derogatory in the funeral home where she was. In the blog I go through it, one of the morticians commented on her appearance, saying she was very average looking and didn't take care of herself. And, you know, he commented on the fact that her manicure wasn't up to scratch and her hair, and she hadn't shaved her legs and stuff that, you know, it would disgust you to think that somebody would talk about somebody like that, let alone somebody who's supposed to be in your care.
Yeah.
As a, you know, that was all really sad in that sense, you know, that even in her death, she was being constantly scrutinized in her appearance and people just wanted a piece of her still. And even in her burial spot, she's buried in the one of the mausoleum vaults, and a man is actually buried on top of her face down. Because he wanted to be buried on top of Marilyn Monroe. And that's just, he was allowed to do that. You know, so even in death, and it's just baffling to me, you know, that something like that would be allowed, but it was. And even in death, she was kind of being exploited a bit. And it's very sad. But I just found that really interesting because it's such a contrast to who you think of when you think of that on-screen
persona.
And another one that I found extremely interesting to research and to look at, and it's probably just from my own, you know, growing up, is the death folklore in Ireland. And three examples of death omens in Irish culture. And I think it's because, you know, Halloween in particular is a very big thing in Ireland, with the birthplace of Samhain. And growing up, we always had these ghost stories. You know, we had the Banshee, who was this woman associated with death. And then we had other stories about the death coach, which is kind of a little bit like Sleepy Hollow when you think about it. It's about a headless horseman who drives a coach. And then you have the fetch, which was kind of like a doppelganger. And if you've seen that, that was a sign of death as well. And it's just so interesting that, you know, growing up, you have these sort of kind of morbid stories and superstitions, I guess. But I think it's because we come from a culture where death is kind of a little bit openly talked about, but also, you know, Halloween is a big thing too.
But, you know, death omens are common across all kinds of places. I mean, you mentioned doppelgangers. That's one of them. Cats, Romans of Death. You've got the Death Watch Beetle. You know, things like three knocks on a door. They're all kind of portents for death.
Big, yeah.
You know, so it's. I think it's something that is there in most cultures and countries around the world. But yeah, Ireland does seem to have its fair share.
Yeah, definitely.
They like having more than one.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, like you say, you do see the links with all other, you know, cultures all over the world. You do see those links, and it's just really interesting to observe and say, oh, I've heard of that before, but we call it this.
But you wrote about the Banshee, didn't you, for the second volume of The Feminine Macabre. And it, again, it was one of the pieces that I just really enjoyed reading in there in more depth. It was fascinating.
Yeah, and I just think she's just a fascinating character. And as I said, like, death is immensely, like, it's an immense topic in Irish culture and heritage. And growing up as, you know, a child in primary school, like, we were told about the Banshee at Halloween, and she was just someone who we were kind of scared of. You know, like, you were scared of her because she has a, you just think of this hag-like woman who's waiting to get you. And for those who don't know who the Banshee is, she was basically this woman with a ghostly complexion, either with flowing red or white hair. And if you heard her scream, you or your immediate family were going to die, or if you seen her, you know. And that, when you hear that as a child, you do be a bit scared, you know. And she's associated with certain families in Ireland, so like Irish families with O in the name, or Mac or Muck in the name. And she's meant to comb her long hair and turn violent or aggressive if anyone tries to take her hair or take her comb for her hair. And she's really linked to that tradition of keening, keening women in Irish society years ago, which was part of Irish mourning tradition. And yeah, she's just fascinating to me. And what's really fascinating about her as well is that she seems to have really conflicting descriptions. You know, some people describe her as young and beautiful and kind of siren-like.
Yeah.
And then the more common aspect is, you know, she's a hag, and that, you know, she's kind of witchy and she's kind of hideous to look at. And she's always depicted as a woman, though.
Which I think is fascinating, because I think if you look at a lot of death omens around, you know, the world, and if you go right back to early civilizations, if you, you know, think about Greek and Roman mythology, you know, with the three fates, you see women being very much characterized with death and with death omens. And, you know, I have my own reasons for why that possibly might be. I think the fact that, you know, women give birth, they are there at the start of someone's life, and often women at the end of someone's life were the people that would be taking care of the body. So the fact that women have always been associated with life and death, and like I said, if you go back to these very early stories, the three fates, for example, they were literally three old women who were spinning someone's fate. So they were there from someone's birth. They were then setting out their path for them, and they were there right at the very end to cut that thread. So they were responsible for the moment of someone's death. And so, you know, you can see these associations with women and death omens going back centuries. And like I said, for me, I think it's fascinating that, you know, women do get associated with these in lots of different cultures. And like I said, that's my theory. Is it because women are there at the start of someone's life and at the end? Is that why? Maybe it's something else. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you that, I mean, people probably don't think it, but there's strong links between birth and death. You know, it's somebody coming into the world, somebody coming out of the world. It's a process, you know, that happens. And it's something we don't always have a lot of control over. And as you said, women were the ones who were associated with, you know, midwives and delivering of a baby. And then women were strongly associated before the undertaking trade really became established as, you know, the people who laid out the body, who cared for the body. And it is just interesting that you have a prominent female figure, such as the Banshee, really stand the test of time and really, you know, is still in Irish society today. And she's been there for hundreds of years and has been adapted. You know, she was, her name was used on a TV show. She's appeared in other episodes of TV programs. And yeah, it's just fascinating to me that she's always depicted as female, but she does have those conflicting sort of youthful versus old hag-like
but again, I think
kind of appearances.
It kind of makes sense if you think about it, because it's those stereotypes of a woman, isn't it?
Mm.
You know, the youthful, yeah, beautiful, siren-like, you know, temptress, and then the other extreme, you know. And so it kind of makes sense that those same kinds of stereotypes would surround these death omens, because I think that's what people fall back onto, particularly mm-hmm. kind of historical representations of women as well, I think, you know, as the,
yeah,
as the kind of the clairvoyant, the psychic, the people that are all seeing, you know, those kinds of things. Again, you see them all kind of coming through in death omens around the world, which again is just fascinating to see how those things have kind of all combined, you know, these threads just coming together.
Yeah, exactly. And it is fascinating just to see how it's interlinked all over the world. How something that you talk about growing up in rural Ireland, this woman, but then you see how she's linked to a lot of other aspects across the world. Mm.
And how her story has evolved and been picked up by, you know, the other outlets and kind of elaborated on or used. And you know, again, all of those other things. But to go back to the root of where it comes from, I think is an important journey to make, to see where and how her story was embedded in a culture and mm-hmm. how still is today, really.
Yeah, and as I said, like, her story is very linked to, you know, the keening traditions in Ireland, and it's very linked to a tradition that's very old. Mm. You know, like, keening went back a long, long way in Ireland, and people were professional keeners. But then you had, as you say, across the world, you have professional keening as well, and you still see it in death cultures today. And it is very interesting how something which is sort of a staple in mourning has evolved into this entity, I suppose.
Definitely. Thank you so mm-hmm. much for your time. It's honestly, I think we could talk for forever.
Yeah, because definitely. You know,
they're just all so unique and fascinating. And again, that's why I love what you're doing, because I go on your Instagram page, I go on your blog, and there's always something new to look at and to come away with. I mean, the other day, seeing the gravestone pictures that you have, you know, the Guinea gravestones, just fascinating, because I've never actually seen them. And they yeah. were posting them, and it was just amazing. So I really do recommend people go and have a look at the different things that you're doing. And I'll make sure that we get all your details into the description that goes up with the podcast, so that they can find you and make sure that you're on the website, etc. So again, they can hop along and see what you're doing, because it's amazing.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. It's been great chatting with you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. So I'll say goodbye, everyone. Bye, everyone. If you have liked this podcast, then there are a number of things that you can do. Come along and follow Haunted History Chronicles on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The links are below in the description to this podcast. Share news of the podcast with friends, family who may be interested. You can also come along and join us on our new website, which has a plethora of other features, including information on our episodes, guests, and a blog which includes guest writers. You can support the podcast further by leaving us a review or taking a look at our Patreon page, and in the process gain access to some extra goodies. Your support and encouragement is always invaluable. Thank you so very much, everyone.